if we keep believing we're just this separate self, just this individual in this scary world of other individuals, all separate from each other, all competing for the limited, apparently limited resources available, that's why we end up in all the circumstances we see around us and in the news right now. When we are very caught and entangled in the character, when we believe that that's who we are, it feels bad. That's suffering. That's the belief in being a separate self. And that's the beginning of the, what I call whirlpools of all the narratives and all the beliefs that come with that character, with that blind hope that one day, you know, I'll find the partner, the house, the job, the financial investment opportunity, whatever it is. We've lived in this false hope that one day security will be found out there. If this feels so terrible, if I'm suffering, if this all looks personal, if this all looks like it's saying something about me or about them, if there's blame, if there's judgments, if there's it shouldn't be like this, all of that is telling me that I'm lost right now. I'm identified with something that I'm not. I'm identified with this character instead of the truth of who I am. So it's a beautiful opportunity to, in whatever way makes sense in that moment, find our way back to that truth of our essential nature. That also means recognizing what we're not, at least not essentially, but that we are the pure awareness, already open, already including everything that's arising, already that space of relief and release and relaxation that we're always looking for. Already okay, always. There's no separation. It is all within awareness. It's all made of awareness. That's it. And then over here in enlightenment, there's all this other world of stuff where we can transmute or include or enlighten with all the stuff we've collected along the way as a human, which still is there, you know, in an awakening experience. Yes, some of that conditioning can get cleared up at the same time as awakening, but some stuff sticks around. And that's the stuff that then we move into an enlightenment journey with, because it needs extra love and care and attention. If we awaken, it makes enlightenment so much easier. If we are enlightening, it makes awakening so much easier. So both are very much interdependent. They're really one process happening at the same time. When we are knowingly, whether very consciously or quietly in the background, when we are being ourselves, everything feels so easy and effortless and in flow. This groundedness, this okayness, that all of this is okay. Fundamentally, for it all to be known as okay is so settling, so calming, so grounding. Then that frees up our human capacity to do what we want to do in this human life.
You're listening to the Non-Duality Podcast. This is Nick Higham from thewholenessofexperience.com. My guest today is Helen Amery, author of The Complete Book of Awakening, which is a comprehensive guide on the journey to self-awareness and non-dual awakening. The book is divided into three parts, focusing on understanding our true nature, recognizing what we are not, and how these aspects relate. It challenges traditional notions of spirituality and self-improvement, aiming to guide readers towards a stable sense of contentment and ease in life. The book offers practical exercises with spiritual insights to help readers explore and understand their essential nature. So welcome to the podcast, Helen.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Yeah, so first of all, what inspired you to write The Complete Book of Awakening, and what's the main message you hope readers will take away?
I'd myself had a full recognition of the non-dual truth of our experience, not really very long before the idea came for the book. And it just, yeah, it just became so obvious as this idea landed in my system that this book had to be written. And the importance for me, and ultimately Sarah, who I ended up co-authoring it with, so important for both of us that this exploration could be made practical and accessible. So I think we'd both gone on journeys where we'd been told there was nothing you could do, and where there was an element of kind of waiting and hoping that one day this realization would drop in, or that for others a meditative practice that one day you'll realize this. And when I reflected on it, I realized how many practical activities had been part of my own journey. And so a big reason for writing it was to bring ultimately a collection from both of our journeys into one place. In a step-by-step, it is like a complete workshop in a book that guides the reader step-by-step with practical exercises all the way along, so that it's not just a sit and read book. It can be, but for it to actually make a difference in your experience, for you actually to have a recognition of your true nature, it is for you to get involved with. It is for the experiential. It is for the direct recognition for yourself, which I know, as you know, Nick, is the only way you're ever going to know the truth of non-duality. So yeah, it was a beautiful, inspired moment when the idea arrived. And as I say, it was just obvious, 100% obvious, this book was going to be written. It had to be written. And bearing in mind, this was probably the fifth or sixth book idea I'd had, and all the previous ones had fallen by the wayside. This one was so different. It was so definite. There's a point in time when I would say it started, which was a conversation with a mutual colleague of ours, Nikki Drew. And I was telling her about the work I was doing with my coach at the time. And he was what was called a three principles coach. So if people who haven't heard of it, the three principles is an understanding originally created by a guy called Sid Banks, and as a way to help more people realize the truth of who they are. So I thought I was working with peers as a three principles expert. And then I was telling Nikki about it, and she said, sounds like he's actually a bit of non-duality as well. And I had never heard of non-duality at this point. And I was kind of disappointed, I have to say, because I thought this three principles was the one answer. I thought I had found the one thing that was the answer to all things. And so when she then had this other word, I was like, oh, you're kidding. There are more things. I thought I'd found the one thing.
Yeah.
But in fact, it was perfect, because then it led me to get really curious about, well, what's the three principles then, and what's non-duality, and how are they the same and how are they different? So it led me into a massive exploration of both of those, and kind of teasing apart the ways they were different and seeing the consistencies of the way they were the same. Fundamentally, Sid had a non-dual awakening. That was what led to him even creating the three P's in the first place. But then the way it's described is much more accessible to a human. It's it's much more accessible to the average person who's suffering in their human experience.
Right.
So anyway, I would say that was a pivotal moment when I went very deeply into non-duality. But when I then, through that process, went back to a book I'd read probably about 6 to 9 months prior, which was a book about the essence of Buddhism, a really stripped out version, which you might start to get the theme from me that I'm not interested in all the fluff around the edges.
Same here.
It's like, no, just give me the stuff, make it really clear, make it really accessible. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So this book by a guy called Steve Hagen, Buddhism Plain and Simple, it's called. It was actually, I'd read it, as I say, 6-9 months prior, because my yoga teacher kept mentioning the Buddha. And I was like, oh, he sounds kind of interesting. And then spotted this book in the bookstore and was like, oh, okay, let's give that a read. It's quite short. That's that also suits me. And yeah, I didn't know anything at the time about anything to do with a spiritual exploration, but I read this book and was like, oh, wow. This is, at the time I was a coach, a psychology-based coach. So I was like, wow, this is like the coaching beliefs I've been taught about in my course to become a coach, but they're like coaching beliefs on steroids. This is like the ultimate coaching beliefs. And of course, now I realize none of it is belief. It has to be seen. This isn't let's add a whole bunch of new beliefs into our system. But at the time it looked like, oh, these look like really good beliefs to follow, to try and weave into your life. Anyway, having had that conversation with Nikki, done a whole bunch of exploration, I then revisited that book that I'd read all that time ago. And I was just reading it going, oh my goodness, this is pure non-duality right here. Yes, with the Buddhist language of, you know, dukkha, and I can't even remember, there's five things and eight things and whatever all that stuff is. But I was like, but gosh, fundamentally, this is non-duality. It's saying exactly the same thing I've been exploring for the last probably year by that point. And it really blew me away because I could now appreciate that book at a whole deeper level than I had when I first read it. But I could see that within me that knew this was the way to go, it had already seen that on the first reading. It was like it had already woken up, and then everything unfolded from that point onwards. At the human level, it just looked like it was the conversation with Nikki that sparked it all. But yeah, for sure, non-duality had already come into my world at that point.
What I love about the book is that it isn't theoretical. It's very, it feels like a conversation. I think the way you've written it, it feels like you're speaking directly to the reader, and it does feel like a workshop. It feels very accessible and very engaging and, like you say, very practical. How do you define non-dual awakening, and why is it significant in today's world?
Yeah, so for us, we're quite tight with our definition, and I know not every spiritual teacher or guide is the same, and that's fine. As a person receiving those teachings, I always just invite people to really check if somebody's talking about awakening or enlightenment. You know, what does that person actually mean by that? Because what they mean could be different from what I mean. So nobody has a commodity on or a trademark on any of these words. So it's great to always check, what do you actually mean by that? So yeah, so for us, non-dual awakening is purely the recognition of our essential nature. And as you described through the journey of the book, therefore that also means recognizing what we're not, at least not essentially. And therefore, with part three of the book, how, in fact, that is all one. There is not a separate essential nature of who I am and then all the other stuff that I'm not. At the end of the book, we bring that back into the full circle of it all being included. And that for us is, it's a very simple definition of awakening, really. It's very constrained in some ways, but we find helpfully to distinguish that from the clearing up of our psychological experience, which we would term enlightenment, because that feels like a lightening of our human experience. So, and that was actually something that was part of the initial realization for me, which led to this book being so clear to write, because I then saw, oh, this awakening piece, it's just this recognition of our essential nature, to see that all of this is awareness appearing as all of this in awareness. That's it. And then over here in enlightenment, there's all this other world of stuff where we can transmute or include or enlighten with all the stuff we've collected along the way as a human, which still is there. You know, in an awakening experience, yes, some of that conditioning can get cleared up at the same time as awakening, but some stuff sticks around. And that's the stuff that then we move into an enlightenment journey with, because it needs extra love and care and attention. And so that, for me, coming to your point about why is it significant? Oh my goodness, all of that. Because if we awaken, it makes enlightenment so much easier. If we are enlightening, it makes awakening so much easier. So both are very much independent, interdependent. They're really one process happening, yeah, at the same time. But the impact on our experience as an individual is huge. For me, and obviously I can only ever really know my own experience, I didn't even realize how much anxiety I was carrying as like a background discomfort. It was only once it was gone that it was like, oh, I used to have like a stomach lurch every time that kind of thing happened, and that's disappeared. Wow. This groundedness, this okayness, that all of this is okay. And how that doesn't then stop us having a human yes or a no to something, but that fundamentally for it all to be known as okay is so settling, so calming, so grounding. Then that frees up our human capacity to do what we want to do in this human life. Whereas otherwise, if we keep believing we're just this separate self, just this individual in this scary world of other individuals, all separate from each other, all competing for the apparently limited resources available, that's why we end up in all the circumstances we see around us and in the news right now. So, God, significant? Yeah, 100%. Because the more we're awakening and the more we're enlightening, the more we are living as that aligned love, that unconditional love that we are, and living is the clear expression of who we are as a human. It's just beautiful.
Yes, because we can't deny the human experience. There is an appearance of being human and living a human life in a world. All of that doesn't go away upon recognition. And so often what's spoken about is the process of integration or deepening. Like you said, some stuff sticks around, some conditioning sticks around. And in my work with people I meet with, it's really getting close to that stuff, really bringing it close and exploring it, exploring the texture of it energetically beyond the interpretations we have of that stuff, of those self-concepts, those core wounds, and to really delve into their nature. What is the nature of this stuff that's sticking around? And we find that the nature is this non-thing that we're talking about, reality, for lack of a better word, life. And so it's not that we have to really integrate anything. It's more about recognizing, it's already included. This stuff I'm trying to get away from is actually included because it's not what I think it is, which means I'm not who I think I am. And so the integration happens through peeling away those labels, those stories, and really seeing the nature of what's there. That does have a lightening effect. And along with that lightening, the recognition of okayness, all is well, you're always home, there's always justice, awareness expressing itself, and there's nothing apart from awareness, because there's only awareness expressing itself. All is held by awareness, all is created by awareness, and we are that.
Yeah. It's a lovely example, Nick, of that correlation, that relationship between awakening and enlightenment. Because, yeah, absolutely, that coming into the relationship with our thoughts, with our feelings, with our physical sensations, that in itself supports an enlightenment, because it's the becoming unafraid of that human experience. When we explore beneath that layer of mental feeling state, we find a much more fluid experience of emotion, which is much closer to our experience of who we are, which is much more, usually much more gentle, much more enjoyable, even, you know, even sadness and anger that sometimes we've turned away from so much. We find that actually these pure emotions are very beautiful. There's nothing to be afraid of. And the more we see that, then the less we kind of go into that almost domino effect of being afraid of the emotion that then takes us into the mental feeling state, which is feels worse. That is our suffering. Because we're looking broadly at the whole thought, feeling, emotion system, and absolutely saying, well, what is it really? What is it really like? Let's get in close to this. And all the way through recognizing the fact that all of this is appearing within awareness, within me, awareness, not within a head, not within a brain. Nobody's ever had an actual experience of their brain. So we're really dropping out of all concepts like that as well to go, yeah, where does this thought come from? Where does it go to? To really see our experience as it is. And then, yeah, it leads you directly back to the awakening, the recognition of the essential nature of all. The essential nature of that thought, feeling, physical sensation is the same nature as we find when we ask, who am I? It all leads back to the same home.
Absolutely. And that realization is liberation.
Yeah.
Because there's no bondage, there's no stuckness, there's no limitation or narrowness here. Just life exploring itself, its infinite potential. And we can call that illusion, we can call that Maya, but really what Maya means is magic. That's the literal translation of the word Maya.
Oh, interesting.
So this is a magic show. This is a magic show. You know, it's not something to get rid of or even transcend.
Mm.
Because the nature of magic, the nature of Maya, is transcendental when you really explore it.
Mm.
Yeah. And this is not a conceptual understanding, is it? It's not a conclusion in the intellectual sense. it is, and I always use the word recognition, it's recognition of the obvious. Ah, this is obvious. Oh, my goodness, it's this way. Nothing to prove, nothing to figure out. No hierarchies.
Yeah, I saw that literally this morning. I was remembering back to how my life used to be so consumed, really, by non-dual podcasts and articles and videos and learning, which on some level was useful to have some conceptual language to use around it, but wasn't the thing that would ever make the difference with my experience. But I saw this morning how the reason that fell away so much in the recognition of who we are was because there was no longer that idea that somebody else knows better than me, that somebody else can educate me in this. It's that I don't need that. I am this, and I will always learning. Like, it's not a right, I cut myself off from the world now, but it's now not learning in order to get it right. It's now learning out of interest and out of, oh, how does that person say it? And how does this person say it? And what alternative metaphor might that person use? Out of interest, out of curiosity, out of enjoyment. Whereas before it was like, I need to get the right answer. I need to, yeah, I need to be good and get this right and know it. Somebody out there is going to tell me, show me, make me see it. Many people who come to the book will say, and who come to me as clients, I'm sure who come to you as clients, the recognition that, oh, I get all this intellectually, I get all this conceptually, but my life is no different. It's not changing my experience. And that for me is exactly why this book is here. It's exactly why you and I do that deeper work with people at the energetic level, because it's that changes our experience in the human life. No amount of intellectual understanding will ever do that. So it's so important, that distinction.
So this is a really, I feel, a fresh exploration of spirituality, of life, identity, experience. How does your approach in the book differ from traditional teachings on spirituality and self-improvement?
So one way it certainly differs, at least compared to the very traditional non-dual teachings, is that we start with the who you are exploration. So traditionally, in non-dual Advaita Vedanta, you'd begin by the stripping away of what you are not, the neti-neti process. And we consciously chose to put that after the exploration of who you are. And in fact, one person said to me, your book seems great, but you've put it the wrong way around. you've put the neti-neti in the wrong place. And it's like, well, you know, fair enough. If that's what works for somebody. What we really wanted was, because this is a book, we're not in an environment where we're in close relationship with the people who are reading. Not necessarily, of course, with some of them we are. We wanted to make sure it was a book that was grounded in stability, because the neti-neti process can be very disruptive. It can be challenging. It can lead to us feeling like we've lost our footing a little bit, like we're not quite sure who we are. So we really wanted to flip that paradigm and start with the who you are, so that you start with the recognition of your essential nature. You start with that grounded knowing, from which then you explore, okay, so now what am I not? And that doesn't stop people. It's not as if people always get to the end of part one and go, oh, amazing, I know exactly who I am all the time now. You know, what we find is that people will then move into part two and start to feel disrupted by the process of what you're not, and can then dip back into part one to go back to a particular exploration or particular chapter or whatever it is that's right for them in that moment, to kind of remember that grounding and then continue forward with part two again. So we found that's been really helpful to order it in that way. Again, given that many people are reading it without us there beside them, as obviously traditionally, you know, you'd be off with your guru, supported 24/7 as and when needed. That's not what this is like. So yeah, I guess we've created a different version, a different way, so that people can follow the journey and have that guidance. And like you said, you know, with us talking to you, as you know, as though we're talking to you through the book, people have said it feels like a conversation with you. They've said every question I have at the end of the previous chapter gets answered in the next one. You know, that is the feeling that people are getting from it, that we're there alongside you, and we have other ways of being alongside you more deeply if that's what people want, through various different course options. But if people just want the book, then that's okay, that's enough. You've got it all there in a book.
There's often a misconception that non-duality is all about the inward facing path, that it denies experience. What are some common misperceptions that you've come across about non-duality, and how does your book address them?
I think you've just hit on a classic one there, Nick. Yeah, lots of people come to us and they'll be talking about teachers like, you know, the Neo-Advaita people, and they're like, well, how does their stuff fit with your stuff? Because you don't seem to be saying the same stuff as them. And in some ways we are, but we also say we're not, because the reason it's called The Complete Book of Awakening is because we do continue that path into part three and the relationship of who you are with what we've just said you're not, to see that they are one, that there isn't this awareness that I really am here and all this stuff that I've just excluded in the process over there. There is something here that I am. So we don't go into the realm of there is no you, which a lot of non-dual teachers will talk about, and which isn't wrong. There is a part of the journey which is very helpful. I found it very helpful on my path to go through the part of the stage of the journey that was about there is no you, there is no chooser, there is no decider. It was very helpful for a certain amount of time. And there was a movement on beyond that. So at one time I thought that was it. I thought that was the peak of a non-dual understanding, was to be able to walk around saying, well, there's nobody really here and there's nothing happening and there's not really a you at all, you know? And something in me obviously knew that wasn't the end, because I did keep going. And that was massively important to both of us, because we'd both continued on. In fact, Sarah hadn't even really had to go into that part like I had done. But it was important to both of us that we moved into this completion, this wholeness. The reason it's called non-dual, you know, how could we say it's not non-dual? If we're saying there's nobody here, it's like, well, what's this body then? What's this character of Helen that's showing up? And, you know, you said before about it being used as the word illusion, this world being an illusion. It's like, well, I remember sometimes thinking, well, it might be, but it seems to be the only world I've got. So I'd kind of quite like to know what it is and enjoy it, rather than walk around going, oh, it's all illusion, it's not real, it doesn't really matter, there's nobody here anyway. It just didn't sit right. And so that's been a huge and important part of this book, that we support that movement through to part three, which is the bringing it all together, the integration of you, as you've talked about, the inclusion of all, to see there's no separation. It is all within awareness. It's all made of awareness. That recognition is what gets called love. And so we find ourselves walking around the world with so much more love and compassion for ourselves and for others, because we know in the depths of who we are that this is all one, that this is not separate people with separate awarenesses. It's awareness within which there are the appearance of people. And then that love then supports that enlightenment process, because it's that soaking of that love that we are into the whole system, all the thinking system, all the feeling system, all the emotional system, all the physical system. And as that love soaks in, then that's the enlightenment process happening. What I see is that we can trust our own path, we can trust our own unique way. And if we need people around us who can provide those guide ropes, those pointers, those indicators of, oh, you maybe want to look in this direction or do this kind of experiment, or have you checked that? You know, that's the bit that for me is the value of having another person or people with you on the path. It's not to tell you what your path should be. It's not to tell you what to see or how to see it. It's just to say, oh yeah, I've walked this path before. Here's some stuff that tends to happen at this point in the path. Here's some stuff that might help you on this point in the path, some of which may and may not be useful. But it's that value of at least having somebody who can say, which is really, again, the point of the book, here's the map. Here's the map. We've walked this. Let us walk this with you so that you find your unique journey on it. But this is the path. Like, this is the reliable, well-worn path that's been walked by thousands for centuries. Yeah, here it is. You have a go. See what you think.
In this exploration, and as recognition dawns, it can feel like we're oscillating between clarity and a personal sense of self, feeling like we're experiencing truth and then being pulled back into the character's world and the character's life and the character's problems. Is this something you address in the book?
Yeah, so that oscillation is so normal as we kind of reorient ourselves to that being the truth of who we are, rather than the character which we've just habitually identified as for so long. We remember the fact that, oh, my nature is to feel at ease inherently. In recognizing it, we come to get to know it again. We come to remember it and become familiar with the feeling of it. Distinguishing between, am I identified as myself, my true nature right now, or am I identified as the character? Because when we are knowingly, whether very consciously or quietly in the background, when we are being ourselves, everything feels so easy and effortless and in flow, which is one of the explorations that we bring in chapter 3, and not absent of challenge, you know, not absent of activity, but everything happens obviously easily, next step, next step, next step, versus when we are very caught and entangled in the character, when we believe temporarily that that's who we are, it feels bad. That's suffering. That's the belief in being a separate self. And that's the beginning of the, what I call whirlpools of all the narratives and all the beliefs that come with that character. And the suffering is perfect because it wakes us back up. It's there. It's meant to not be enjoyable, because that's the way the system gets our attention to go, hang on, who do you think you are? Who are you really? It's the beautiful wake-up call for us to come back and check. If this feels so terrible, if I'm suffering, if this all looks personal, if this all looks like it's saying something about me or about them, if there's blame, if there's judgments, if there's it shouldn't be like this, all of that is telling me that I'm lost right now. I'm identified with something that I'm not. I'm identified with this character instead of the truth of who I am. So it's a beautiful opportunity to, in whatever way makes sense in that moment, find our way back to that truth of our essential nature, to remember that we are the pure awareness, as you said, already open, already including everything that's arising, already that space of relief and release and relaxation that we're always looking for, already okay, always.
Perhaps as a way to bring this conversation to an end, you could take us through one of the exercises you include in the book.
Yes, so very happy to do an exploration. And I was thinking about one of the earlier ones, which kind of speaks a little bit to what we've been talking about today. So exploration 1.2. So this is in part one of the book. So when we're exploring who we are, the title of the exploration actually is Why Bother with Awakening? So I'll just read it through. It's a relatively short one, and I'll give the context to it as well. Obviously, it's coming after 1.1, which has just established that there is an I am in everything we've ever said about ourselves in any circumstance, to recognize the beginning of, yes, there is something constant that I've always referred to when I've said I or I am. And so now we're taking that a level deeper to see that reliability. So if this knowing awareness is who we are, it might seem like there's nothing else to do. It is reasonable to question if knowing our essence adds anything to life. We are suggesting this. The difference it makes is that we now have solid ground to stand on for how we approach life. When we say someone's grounded, there's a reason for that. We know grounded people are nice to be around. We feel safe around someone who seems to have a strong sense of self. And the reason is that they feel secure in themselves, in a way that is authentic and has integrity. A grounded person has a better experience of life without compromising who they are, and that feels like something we'd want for everyone. Grounding offers us a feeling of security, and we find our grounding in something that can't be changed or taken away. Let's experiment with why we might not feel on solid ground if we aren't clear on who we are. So the question for this experiment: when you think of the content of your experience, what can you point to that hasn't changed? And our suggestion: if everything in life, in the content of life, everything we perceive, sense, think, and feel changes, then these things cannot provide security. Now for the experiment. Let's look at what feels secure in life. Write a list of some of the things that are going on in your life. The people around you, the buildings in your local area, the nature spots you like to visit, the work you're doing, your activities, what you like to read, listen to, or watch. Now look at the list and ask, which of these will never change, and which will never die or disappear in some way? It's normal to not find anything constant in our daily experience, because all these things change. Then expand your list. Think of things in the world, in the cosmos. Think of the most stable thing you can, the thing that you think would last forever. For everything you come up with, check honestly. Will this thing stay the same forever? Or is it always changing? And will this thing really be around forever? Did you find anything on your list that still stands as permanent and constant? Double check. And do get in touch and tell us if you find something, as this will be a first. Helen's kids said, "the sun," when she asked them the question. But even that is in a perpetual state of change and is expected to eventually end. A member of the book group who first tested this book said gravity. But is gravity the same everywhere in the universe? Even everywhere on Earth? If you thought you had found something permanent and constant, and given these examples of the sun and gravity, have another check. Conclusion. The content of life is always changing, and even the most consistent elements will always appear, be around a while, and then go. Why would we rely on these things for our security? Now, if the most permanent thing in the whole universe is not inherently secure and reliable, what is? Connect back to our first exploration. Maybe you already found it.
Yeah, powerful. Really clear, no fluff. Just pointing to direct experience. What is it that hasn't changed? Anything you can point to has changed. What are you left with? What are we left with when we realize all is transient, all is temporary? What is it that is changeless? You don't find anything, but the questioning itself brings to the forefront that which is causeless, which never changes in what it is, but is always changing in its appearance, in its expressions.
It really highlights the distinction we make throughout the book with the content of experience versus that context, the awareness, the who I essentially am, within which this content appears, with which it is known. And it was one of the most impactful recognitions for me towards the end of my journey, in that awakening aspect where it's like, oh, that distinction was just so clear. That, yeah, everything but awareness is the content. All of that stuff is going to keep changing. And that, yeah, that recognition, none of it is going to ever provide security. So in that almost blind hope that we've lived in, that one day You know, I'll find the partner, the house, the job, the financial investment opportunity, whatever it is. We've lived in this false hope that one day security will be found out there. So it's very relieving to realize we won't. Sounds kind of paradoxical, but it's very relieving to realize that we're never going to find security out there in the content of life, because it stops us trying somewhere that it's never going to happen. And we fall back into the innate security of who we are.
Absolutely. How can people find out more about you and your work?
So there's two places. Sarah and I set up a separate business for the book called Thoughtful Raven. So thoughtfulraven.co.uk is where all the stuff is to do with the book. It's where all the courses are. It's where our community is, everything. And other books are going to be coming into that publishing brand as well, including our next one, which we will write soon, The Complete Book of Enlightenment. So that's all the book stuff sits in Thoughtful Raven. That's kind of the home of the awakening exploration. And then my own business is Wild Fig Solutions. And that's where I focus much more on the enlightenment process and much more on the especially energetic aspects of clearing our childhood conditioning so that we can live in that aligned expression of who we really are as who we're here to be. So it's my work over there is very much grounded in the non-dual, but it's much more involved in the human experience.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Helen. It's been great talking with you today and sharing this resonance. And yeah, let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks so much, Nick.